Good evening. This is Mae Bressel. The title of this broadcast is World Watchers. It's 1 hour long. I hope you tape it off the air and remember it and play them back for years to come. This is broadcast number 774, October the 6th, 1986. Now, don't forget, those of you who get World Watchers on KKUP that live in Cupertino or in Santa Cruz, or even if KKUP goes down to Big Sur, a lot of areas around there, you might try to get Monday evenings at 9 o'clock, because following World Watchers program from 8 to 9, I'm going to start a one-hour talk show from 9 to 10, and you can call in and ask questions, and I can get to know you, and we will share a lot of new material that isn't on the program, because it can barely be covered, the news of the week, in just 1 hour a week on World Watchers. So try to get to the telephone and try to listen on Mondays. Now, there's a conflict because the regular program is being aired up there at 9 o'clock. Just tape one program and listen to the other live and choose whichever one. Take the live one and tape the other one, and then you'll have both of them that you can refer to and listen to, because they're entirely different types of shows, the call-in shows and the other prepared programs. Now, a series of events have happened to the Soviet military. I wonder whether World War III has actually begun, and I just want to cite those very quickly. One was the end of May, the period 2 nights before the summit meeting in Japan, when the Chernobyl reactor broke down and caused nuclear radiation to spread throughout the world. And we've heard a lot of that in terms of anti-Soviet propaganda for a long, long time. And I believed, because of a series of many articles that I read, that this was an agent provocateur inside job. On September the 7th, a Soviet ship sunk in the Black Sea. There were about 1,000 people aboard and a great many casualties, and the captain was reprimanded, and it seemed to be, in quotes, careless, but nevertheless it happened just shortly after the Chernobyl. On September the 17th, a Soviet missile mishap was reported by the United States officials. A long-range missile exploded, evidently, during August, a month before, but the United States picked it up that they had problems with a missile that they were testing. And then this past week, the nuclear submarine, the Soviet submarine in the Atlantic, 400 miles off of Bermuda, sunk. This morning, when I was watching CNN, this morning being October the 6th, when you get this tape later, that was the day I was listening, Admiral Thomas Moore is being interviewed. He is very much involved with Henry Kissinger and the Watergate scandal, stealing papers off the desk of Richard Nixon. Admiral Moore is on the board of directors of Western Goals. That includes John Singlaub, the late Larry McDonald, Roy Cohn, and a group of military right-wing experts, also part of the Helionetic Star War contracts. And he was using this submarine going down for vicious anti-Soviet talk that I luckily taped off the air. And then he said, we had lost two submarines, and the Soviet Union up to now had lost two submarines, so the score is now 3-2 instead of 2-2. And he said that the two that we lost, one was the Thrasher and the other was the Scorpion. These are nuclear submarines. And he said the Scorpion was damaged by a missile of our own that we, meaning the people in the Navy, somehow had an altercation with their own missile, and that caused the submarine to blow up. So I'm wondering if anyone could sabotage the Soviet submarine and duplicate, if we know so well why ours went down, duplicate it at this time. When we have accidents, such as the Challenger or missile tests and so forth, there are a lot of reporters and people that write that the U.S. is sabotaging the United States. When the Soviet Union has four terrible disasters in this short time period, they are called dangerous or inept and incapable of doing scientific things accurately. And it seems to smack of a lot of questions. And I ask, is this the beginning of World War III? Is this the way it's going to start on us slowly and then build up? I mentioned several weeks ago, I did two broadcasts on the Cameroon explosion and the 1,700 people that died there, and my belief that it was a neutron bomb. And I specifically went into the role of Prime Minister Shimon Peres visiting Cameroon at the time, and bringing doctors and medical team in while Perez was in another city far away with the president of Cameroon, the people were from our Defense Department from Israel were working on those bodies. Well, interestingly enough, October the 5th, just this past week, in fact, yesterday, in the San Francisco Examiner, there's a story, British M-bombs reported, and many of you might have seen on the news, that for the last 20 years they've been working on nuclear power and that they have a stockpile of atomic bombs, and they identified a technician in secret underground bunker who had said that these were available and made. And then he also made a charge, which the Israeli government quickly dismissed in the British press, that Israel had produced a neutron bomb. Now, I thought the possibility of our delivering it over them, because I know Ronald Reagan began the construction of the bombs right away as soon as he was president, and I visualized a stealth airplane being able to fly and deliver that so there would be no sign of an airplane detected over Cameroon at that time, just preceding that explosion, although somebody on KGO radio called up and said something about an airplane being seen. The Monterey Herald had a story this week that General admits the stealth exists, but if Israel has the neutron bomb over there, then they don't have to take it from the United States to Israel. I'm going to update a lot of Cameroon later, but I think it was important to mention this right now because of the fact that the allegations that Israel has a neutron bomb and the relationship of Shimon Peres and Cameroon government over the past 3 years, and Ronald Reagan's using the news media, as I cited before, for pushing the neutron bomb among the countries in Europe, just as George Shultz and Ronald Reagan and Admiral Poindexter were exposed this week for using the news media as an exchange chance to attack Libya, kill Gaddafi, and take over Libya, and building up how dangerous he is through the news media, even though there was no indication of that at the time at all. Now, I'm going into that in a certain chronological order, but I want to mention the similarity of the media with the neutron bomb and the fact that Israel does, in fact, have the neutron bomb. Now, the past 3 weeks, I've been talking about terrorism and cited the neutron explosion, the arrest of Nicholas Danilov, the Pakistan hijacking, the shooting of the Israelis in Istanbul, the riots in Chile with Pinochet that gave him more power than ever and the ability to sweep anyone out who is against his administration. But that was 3 weeks ago, even the Paris bombings. I went into details about the Paris bombings, but the news stories have a life of 1 to 2 to 3 weeks. So you can take all the September stories, wrap them in a ball of cotton and put them with mothballs and just wait for the buildup again. But I believe that all those instances were agent provocateur cases and that our allies have caught on and that we're on the brink of something that has beginning has the odor of that World War III, and they're getting a little bit suspicious of us. The London Times had a story after the hijacking in Turkey. Reagan ready for revenge, but he must wait for the target. And he's waiting and waiting. But if he says Libya was involved in it and Libya wasn't, then it affects the oil supplies to all of Europe and the industrialized nations and into Japan, and the Middle East would be a mess if we attack, and I believe that some of them are catching on. Now, if the terrorism is out of the news for the past week, and it certainly was, there wasn't hardly a thing in the newspaper, what else was going on? Well, in the first place, burying all the terrorism without an unsolved hijack or an unsolved person shooting in the synagogue, and the inside job in Chile being described as shooting Pinochet as being inside job. Well, the series of stories this week that was so outrageous began, of course, with Nicholas Danilov being let out. Of course, the president said he wasn't going to do it, and he did, after he gets a letter on September the 19th and literally is forced to do that. He summoned Mr. Shevardnadze to the White House, the representative from the Soviet Union, to say how strongly he felt about Danilov, and that day Gorbachev sends a letter. You come see me in Iceland, and Reagan says, okay, I'll see you in Iceland. So in the first place, Danilov was let out because Ronald Reagan and the administration couldn't have a trial. And next week, I'll go into some of the pieces of proof that Danilov was, in fact, an intelligence agent. And he knew he would crack. He was only there 16 or 17 days. You hear about these people in prisons for years and years, and Amnesty International telling their plights. and political prisoners. Nobody was so soft, so weak, and obviously so guilty as the Danilov family. So they had to get him out. Reagan had to get him out at any price. And the price, of course, the second person out was Mr. Zakharov. He was a spy, and Danilov was a journalist. That's what we were told, and we wouldn't think of trading them because there isn't any similarity. And out goes Zakharov back to the Soviet Union, and in comes Nicholas Danilov. I'm so tired of hearing about him, but I'm sure he'll get the Nobel Peace Prize, and we'll hear about him for years to come. And he'll have all the bestseller books by Random House and the proper agents to distribute these books and talk shows. It will go on and on. But important events followed that. The arrangement of the summit meeting, which the president was going to have, wasn't going to have, and the notes from Mr. Gorbachev, well, I'll meet you in Iceland. Iceland being the perfect place, just the idea that because of the Cold War, to meet so far away in Iceland really pleased me. Now, there were articles after the agreement to meet in the newspapers, a lot of interesting ones, and I'm sure you've seen many. There was one from the San Francisco Chronicle, Reagan, I can't afford to have my hands tied, and he begs a Democratic controlled Congress to help him with his arms budgets and his weapon needs, and he's going to blame the Democrats if his hands are tied. His hands are tied because of blackmail, and he wants this bipartisan Congress to give him all the weapons he wants. Another story, Reagan aides fly to Iceland, blackout of media sought for the meeting. This is supposed to be secret. Sure, they met once before, and it was secret. They want a similar blackout, and this is at the behest of Secretary of State Shultz, that the media not be there. The media can't be there unless they sneak some way or get pieces of information, because Reagan is meeting at a point where Danilov was guilty. This summit was called because Gorbachev knows he was guilty, and Gorbachev may even know more about the agent provocateurs, any incident such as the Challenger, the KAL, the kidnappings in Pakistan, the synagogue shooting, whatever the Soviet intelligence has on the United States, or the attempted the shooting of Pinochet, not to kill him, but to nick his arm. They're going to talk about those things because, and the lies about Libya, I'm sure they've had enough. I know just sitting here in Carmel, I've had enough of day after day of barrage of lies and obvious situations. So they like this that are creating such a storm. So they have decided to have this meeting, as I say, that started on the 19th of September. And then after that, Danilov went out, and they are going to meet. Cincy Mercury had an interesting article. Pre-summit has foreign policy community squirming. And this is an interesting article by James Goldsborough. That we don't call this a summit, we call it a pre. And the gist of it is that he said the foreign policy people like Henry Kissinger, Brent Scowcroft, and Robert McFarlane and William Hyland, to name four, are aghast that Reagan penciled in a new meeting with Gorbachev on so little notice. Kissinger is very uneasy. McFarlane is leery. Reagan, said Scowcroft, is prepared to pay a lot for the summit. And when I say a lot, I say again, when the KAL went down, there was a story in a newspaper, Reagan is behind this, Reagan would be out of office. The telephone calls down to the Challenger to take off that very cold morning and launch because Krista McAuliffe was on there. And then these terrible terrorisms in the synagogue, at the airport, the agent provocateurs in Paris that are linked to the CIA, to Francois Jeannot. And this article is telling the hysteria of the Reagan team and the Kissinger team behind him. Because what is he going to say? What's he going to give away? Well, behind Henry Kissinger is the Fritz Kramer, numero uno in the United States, that controls the strings. But he doesn't come out and talk. It's McFarlane, Hyland, Scowcroft, and Kissinger. And the article says the criticism of these men who have been involved in so many summits themselves is puzzling until one thinks about who they are. They are Kissinger and his proteges. The first three are former national security advisors, cronies of Kissinger's. These men don't much trust presidential diplomacy. They don't trust the State Department. They believe in back-channel work in secret diplomacy, secret even from the State Department, which is the government into itself. You know that. They believe you don't improvise summits, even pre-summits. Everything is agreed and decided upon months ahead, and above all, they are diplomats, they're not diplomats, who believe that diplomacy is a hallowed art with methods and procedures honed over the centuries, meaning the empires and the German Empire that Kissinger loved so much, never public, never improvised, never influenced by vicissitudes such as the Danilov affair. Diplomacy is impersonal, it is secret and slow. And then the article goes on, and here comes Reagan, itching with eagerness, itching to communicate, doing everything, along with Schultz. If you are Kissinger, Scowcroft, or McFarland, you are appalled. And the point is that they couldn't stand the trial of Danilov at that time in the Soviet Union because the Senate elections, the House elections are coming up. Reagan absolutely wants to win the congressional elections, and with all the other disasters that are coming down in this country, he couldn't have a newsman from U.S. News and World Report being a spy for so long in the Soviet Union. And this article goes on how Kissinger set up secret meetings in Moscow and in Paris regarding the Vietnamese and in China for settling the Vietnamese conflict, and that he did things differently, secretly, and Kissinger chose the issue of a pre-summit. It says that it is interesting that Kissinger has chosen the issue of a pre-summit to take on the Reagan administration, something he has not done up to now. Now, Kissinger was given all of Central America to take care of with John Singlaub and the Contras and the death squads. One person a day is being killed in El Salvador. But this article says that he has a Byzantine diplomacy, and he may have a peek because Reagan had called Nixon and not him for advice. And the article is about Kissinger must have choked when he heard that Secretary of State Schultz explain how Reagan accepted Gorbachev's offer on the 19th of September. Quotes, "Now we hadn't explicitly thought about a meeting between two heads on preparation for the U.S. summit meeting. But as the president thought about it and as we talked about, we thought, well, this could be a good idea. Why not?" And as I say, all of these various things that have happened that can blackmail. I can't wait till Reagan's out of office to see the books and studies that pour out, and people are fawning all over him now when they tell the truth. And the article goes on, the question that clearly has Kissinger and his mates fulminating, what is happening to Reagan? He made it through 6 years without a summit and just as long without a serious arms control offer, and now suddenly he's flying off on 10 days' notice. Now, that's very important because for the past 3 weeks I've been saying that he has set up agent provocateur situations that are very explosive, and it may even have to be with the people that were arrested involving Chernobyl or the Russian ship that sunk, that they have the goods on Ronald Reagan, and Ronald Reagan is forced to go, and the buddies around him are absolutely, according to this article, appalled. Then it concludes, what mostly concerns Henry Kissinger and his friends is that Reagan, the demurrage of Star Wars, might cut a deal in Iceland that puts limits on the program's developments. Now remember that Fritz Kramer, Henry Kissinger's mentor since Army Intelligence days, shares an office with Daniel Graham, who's the head of High Frontier and Star Wars. And Mr. Gorbachev said Star Wars is a first strike offense against us. And the Project Paperclip scientists and Wernher von Braun and Walter Dornberger were all brought here for a first strike against the Soviet Union. And now they're panicky. Kissinger says, what if he makes a discussion of Star Wars? The Soviets have stuck fast to their position that limits on the strategic defense are linked to limits on strategic offenses. And Kissinger is worried. To leave it to freewheeling discussion that was mentioned by Secretary Schultz, he said, I think it's very dangerous. When Kissinger leaves out is that negotiations on the link between the offense and defense have been going on for 2 years. But Reagan is going to this summit. He will be out of office in a couple of years. He has to decide what kind of a image he leaves when it's over. And I think he also has to decide how much he's been blackmailed and what's drawing him here. And no wonder these people are frantic. Now, I'll do more on the articles of the summit, but I want to get through the week as it was because there are a lot of other important situations. Besides being forced to meet at the summit, the next important situation was that the hostages in Lebanon were speaking up and were furious against Ronald Reagan. And this is the first time in the 6 years that he's been confronted, and they talked about the duplicity, the hypocrisy, the families were on him, David Jacobson and Terry Anderson, and Reagan tried to say they were only forced to say what they did. They were under the coercion by the people who captured them. And this is totally different, and Reagan got very mad. Maybe you might have seen him leaving for Camp David. In fact, it is the most angry that I've seen him in public. And he says, this is a totally different situation. Well, of course it is. These men were picked up in Lebanon, and the others were, Danilov was in the Soviet Union. And the purpose of the tirade against the Soviet Union, night and day, there are hundreds of countries in this world, and we never let up on the Soviet Union while we send atomic weapons to China, is because it is the Soviet Union, and the State Department and the National Security Agency and the Defense Department, the CIA, are run by foreign-born white czarists, white Russians, and people from the Ukraine who are building up the momentum for this war. And Lebanon has nothing to do with them. They could care less whether these people live or die, or whether that Mr. Buckley was kidnapped, lived or died. Now, the kidnappings in Lebanon are interesting. Mr. Jamil is one of our allies. He was put in there by the CIA and the Defense Department. He never has an interview. Has anyone seen Jamil in the last 2 months? We see King Hussein from Jordan, and we see the heads of states of all the Arab countries. But the very country where all this is going on, do we say we won't deal with you? We won't trade with you to Lebanon. We won't let our airplanes land there because you have these people kidnapped. Lebanon is a country, and it's an ally and a friend. And Reagan says, oh, this is different. We don't know who kidnapped them. We'll ask the man who runs Lebanon who kidnapped them, and he would find out. So Reagan was simply furious. And at the press, just the throwing of the questions at him as he left for Camp David, as I say, his face was livid. And that wrinkle-free, handsome, elderly gentleman became like Dorian Gray, and the skin was falling off his neck. He must usually have a makeup job when he leaves or sees the press, and the cheeks and neck were gathered like an old man, and he was very tense. And one of the big problems that this kind of tension could bring on a heart attack, and then we'd have George Bush. But the pressure is awful. To add to that pressure then, this past week, the Washington Post had the long story by Bob Woodward, how the United States tried to deceive Gaddafi. Well, it turns out they weren't deceiving Gaddafi. They were deceiving us because we spend the millions of dollars for the bombing raids, and we supply the weapons and the B-52s that can fly over there, and coaxing Margaret Thatcher to use Great Britain for bombing Libya. And the article, many of you saw it. If you didn't see it, it was a very large article in the Washington Post, and I'll do more about it with you because the whole process of using the news media didn't end after Watergate. The CIA has used it, and it shows how the Washington Post was used. And as I say, they used the CIA for selling the neutron bomb when there were protests and Alexander Haig was in Germany trying to push it. We use the CIA for that kind of work. Ronald Reagan decided this past week that Bob Woodward has to be deep throat because of his getting a hold of these papers of trying to print things about Gaddafi, the resurgence of terrorism, that he's crazy, that nobody there likes him, on the hopes that he will commit suicide or somebody else will take over the government in Libya. And simultaneously, we have Vernon Walters all over Europe trying to tell our allies that Gaddafi is crazy and that he's dangerous. He's like Adolf Hitler. He's being compared to Hitler. He was armed by Edwin Wilson and Frank Turpel of our CIA and Defense Department. And Vernon Walters has been a public relations man for Morocco for the past 20 years, would like to see Gaddafi cleaned out and get a United States, a 51st state, like the Philippines, next to Morocco on the Mediterranean, I suppose. And Vernon Walters has been going around telling people how dangerous Gaddafi is. And it turns out he isn't, and he wasn't threatening. And actually, the whole story of that Disco Berlin bombing was not Gaddafi at all. The use of the news media for this kind of propaganda can be found in L.A. Herald had a story, White House says Dornan, Representative Robert Dornan claims that Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi bought three hostages in Lebanon and had them killed in revenge for our raids. That was the August 4th, 1985. And another story, hostage bounty alleged, San Jose Mercury, a long story that Gaddafi bought and killed these captives. And this is Representative Dornan of the far, far right working with the CIA and with the national security in continuing this story about how dangerous Gaddafi is, and now we find out at great length that they were telling a pack of lies. Another provocation that we were doing was testing our Navy outside the Soviet Union, and Gaddafi is the little fish. Russia is the big fish. We're getting ready for the psychological war for Russia. Every newscaster, every program puts them down. Start making a record of the things that you're hearing. On September the 30th, this past week, the San Francisco Chronicle had a story, U.S. Navy holds maneuvers off Russia's Pacific coast. Four U.S. warships led by the battleship New Jersey completed a secret show the flag mission off Siberian coast yesterday that featured a deep incursion into the Sea of Okhotsk, that's O-K-H-O-T-S, north of Japan. The New Jersey, two cruisers and a destroyer, went into the area September the 26th under a cover of secrecy and left, steaming through the Kuril Island chain. And this, of course, is the area that the Korean airline KAL-007 was flying over to spy at the time above ground to see their responses. The article said any advance publicity could have been considered provocative by the Soviet Union. Although the ships remained in international water, the Russians considered the Sea of Okhotsk bordered on three sides by Soviet territory as their play pond, said one official. The Soviet response to the ship's presence consisted of occasional visits by reconnaissance planes and the shadowing of U.S. vessels. So while we kept four major ships off of Libya to scare Muammar Gaddafi and make him think that we're going to invade there, we then moved ships before, after, or the same time outside the Soviet Union, close to their borders, and we're doing to the Soviets disinformation, lies, sabotage, all at the same time that we're doing it to Gaddafi, and it isn't just a one-way affair of us against Gaddafi, or it's us against Gaddafi and Fidel Castro in Nicaragua and Angola and Afghanistan, and we are pulling this on many borders with unlimited money and weapons, but the Soviet Union is the target. Somebody who listens to World Watcher sent me a menu from Ronald Reagan's restaurant. It's called Hot Wars to Go, and I think it's interesting because just keeping the fleet outside of Libya while we were told by all our security advisors how dangerous Gaddafi was costing $10 to $30 million, as was, I forget the exact figure, of the Libya bombing earlier in the year. And this restaurant has a list of subjects you can, menus, appetizers, and so forth that you can have. At the Ronnie restaurant, Hot Wars to Go, appetizers, crushed Grenada, cost to taxpayers $59.5 million since the invasion. Honduras, Big Pine, 1, 2, and 3. While you were not looking, the troops and ships sent war material in place for other actions, $39 million. Media mind mixers, free. A sample of metal junk food, scarce, scare words and slanted stories, choice U.S. government approved propaganda. If you can swallow it, you'll swallow anything in the media is free. That's given to you for a little electricity. Main dish, El Salvador stew, which is $1.7 billion, warmed over version of the Southeast Asian recipe. Steamed Nicaragua, which is $80 million, the known cost of covert funding so far. The side order is Guatemalan squash for $87.5 million. Sizzling Costa Rica, $9.2 million since 1985. Half-baked opposition, seasonably available a few days a year. And it says here, no substitutions for social programs or human needs. And I have the address if you wanted, the people who get this out. It's got the details of the menus, but they can add to that the cost of having our ships, you know, going around Siberia or outside of Libya, which runs into millions of dollars, maybe hundreds of millions, for the purpose of scaring Muammar Gaddafi. Now, the next story that broke in the news this week that was totally scandalous, and along with the Washington Post articles, part of it but separate, was George Shultz suggesting that they send Gaddafi to San Francisco to give him AIDS. The time is running out of this first half hour, so I'll begin the second half, because that wasn't funny, and there's a reason George Shultz speaks of that Ronald Reagan talks about Gaddafi liking fancy clothes. These are the heads of the United States government talking at conferences on making war against another country and using the language and the insinuations or the statements that they, like George Shultz, can give AIDS. And I think he can, and he recognizes that AIDS is a weapon of assassination. This isn't a tongue-in-cheek matter. We'll take a one-minute break now, and I'm going back to George Shultz, San Francisco, Gaddafi, and AIDS. It is a very serious matter and shouldn't be taken lightly.